You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Adam DeBurr. Adam, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you, Brainerd.
Adam, let's talk about what you're working on now. And where are you now? Your studio, or where are you talking from?
Yes, we're speaking from my studio in downtown Los Angeles. I've lived here for about 2 years.
And what's happening at the moment? Like, what's going on in your studio, or are you consumed with at the moment? If it's more than one thing, we can go through a few things.
Well, I'm primarily working on a series of batik paintings for an exhibition that will open in Los Angeles at Hunter Shaw Fine Art Gallery in March. So the paintings, thankfully, are almost finished, and now it's time to photograph them and start getting the word out.
So let's talk about that process a minute. You said batik painting, so that sounds like a combination of things, because I've certainly seen your image, and it doesn't look like any batik I've ever seen.
And
I know you're using different types of materials. So can you tell me a little bit about the process of what's happening now?
Yeah, I'll just back up a little bit, give some context for the reason why I use batik. So batik is a wax-resist dyeing technique that is native to Java, Indonesia, which is where my father was born. So the reason my name is DeBurr is because my dad was born in the Dutch East Indies and became became a political refugee following World War II and Indonesian independence. So I grew up in Southern California as just a normal suburban middle-class kid. And then through surfing, first through surfing here and then through surfing elsewhere, I found myself in Indonesia. And then from there started exploring the family history for the first time in like my mid-20s. And then kind of engaging with that history through studying craft, and that's why I use batik to make paintings these days. So the reason that it doesn't look like on the website or the images you've seen of my work, why it doesn't look like batik paintings you've seen before is because they're just these really strange hybrid objects that I think only a person with my very particular ancestry and trajectory could have kind of come to.
So let's to dive right into one. We could talk about something that you're doing now. I've been looking at some things online, and something from last year was called Fool's Cap Map of the World. And it looks like there's batik on there because the medium is described as wax-resistant acrylic ink and graphite on linen. So can we talk about that painting a little bit?
Yeah, so that painting is a recent one. It was finished in the fall. I spent the summer in Oxford teaching art history and drawing, and I spent a lot of time at the Ashmolean Museum and the Bodleian Library, and kind of looking through primarily looking through maps, I guess, or they're just around, and I noticed a little map key on an Italian map from the 15th century or 16th century, and it just had a kind of Harlequin character whose face was the globe. And it just made me laugh to think about, you know, even at the beginning of these colonial projects, like somebody, some cartographer, or somebody had a sense of humor about it and knew they were kind of mucking things up. Now, that's just how I interpreted that image, and I've been told that it can be interpreted in lots of different ways. But that's how I kind of came to that image. That painting was made with the batik process. So I don't know if you're looking at an image online or if you see it in person, all the lines are white, and that's because that's the white of the linen, and that's where the wax, the liquid wax was applied, and then the fabric was dyed around it in different ways. And then once all the coloring's done, the linen is unstretched, and then wax is boiled out.
Okay, so let me just back up to understand that process more. So this is canvas, right? We're
exactly. You're looking at a linen. No, it's a kind of a fine, yeah, fine weave linen, a white linen, a bleached linen.
And so the linen is it's not stretched initially. It's tacked to the wall or something, and you're putting.
It's such a long process having to sort these out. So yeah, so I'll build a strainer, stretch the linen, make the drawing. Then once the drawing is done in graphite, I can trace that drawing with liquid wax, which is a kind of combination of beeswax and a kind of microcrystalline wax. And I use a traditional Javanese tool called a janting, which is kind of a spoon with a little spout at the end. So the wax is being warmed up on a little burner, and then you just keep, you know, over and over and over dipping the janting into the wax, and then the wax flows out, and that's how it's done. Then after that, I use a cold batik process. That's what they would call it if you translated the Bahasa Indonesia. I use a cold batik process to add color first on the front, and then I unstretch it and do it again on the back. Then after that, I'm able to boil out the wax. Then I restretch it.
So when you boil out the wax, you're then taking the entire piece of linen and you're submerging it in water. I mean, it's such an unusual process for painting, right? And it's stretching and not, but so that linen enables itself to be kind of crunched up and boiled to remove the wax part.
Exactly. I mean, that's the only way you can do it, really. So if that piece was not stretched over a strainer, you could wear it. So the reason most people own some sort of wax resist, I mean, pattern fabric. And so most people own a kind of batik. So these paintings could be worn. And I've actually have thought about doing something like that in the future, getting into textile design or something, or using paintings in a different way, rather than just stretched on a wall. But so, and also if you saw the image from the back, it would just be the reverse of what you see on the front. So the color is in the linen, not on the linen. You know, it's not a gessoed surface.
Hmm. It's so interesting. So in the imagery there, you talked about where it came from, Poole's Cat Map of the World. And of course it's full of symbolism, some that, you know, you're bringing to it and that means to you, and also traditional, I guess, medieval symbolism. But what's happening there to you? It seems like such a kind of message-oriented piece. There's so much content in there that seems like it's asking to be uncovered.
To be discerned. Well, I wish that I could give, you know, really concise and articulate response to that question. I don't really know what it's about. I think what it does is suggest, as I said before, just my impression of noticing that map key at the Ashmolean Museum. So this image is influenced by something that I saw at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, UK. And I think it's just, you know, I think a lot about, you know, my father was an immigrant. I only came to understand that in my mid-20s, kind of by a random surf trip. And I just, for the past 10 years, I've really considered myself as, and a lot of my friends, as kind of sojourner artists, traveling artists. And and how we kind of, as we travel through, you know, I don't know how I can really articulate it, but just that we pick up lots of influences as we move around in time and space, and we don't necessarily have to qualify that. But what happens if we do? What happens if we really start interrogating the materials that we use? You know, what is watercolor? Where did it come from? What is oil paint? Where did it come from? You could do that for anything. So because I didn't know anything about batik when I first started in my, when I was about 27, I just had to start from square one and learn all about, you know, its actual history, which is debatable, and then how it's used, how it's been used traditionally, how it can be used today. And then looking at some, you know, contemporary artists and how they've used batik. So one of my favorite artists and a big influence on me, especially about a decade ago, is Yinka Shonabare, who's famous for using what he calls Dutch wax fabrics. And those are essentially a kind of mechanized batik that was invented in the 19th century by Dutch colonists for sale in Indonesia, but it just didn't take very well there. So then it was exported to Africa, and it became a kind of, you know, then it changed there, and it became a kind of symbol for black identity, sub-Saharan black identity. And so Yinka starts understanding that history when he's in graduate school in the UK, and he's buying these fabrics in the Brixton Market in South London. And so that kind of transnational story, that kind of confused postmodern story, is the crux of Yinka Shonabari's entire practice. And it's brilliant and it's beautiful, but I just thought that just didn't feel authentic to me, because my initial paintings, I would buy batiks and maybe collage with them, paint on them, and it just didn't seem thorough enough. So I thought, for my own practice, I'd really like to learn how to make batik myself. So I think to answer your question about foolscap map of the world, the idea that this kind of image first noticed, you know, this would have been a kind of hand-colored etching on a map, on a hand-colored map from the 16th century. So what does it mean when a contemporary artist from Los Angeles with these kind of Dutch-Indonesian ancestry like notices that, sees humor in that, and then translates it into batik? It's just adding layers and layers onto things.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And the imagery that you're working on now for the upcoming show, is it similar, or how does it depart from this?
Well, for the upcoming show, I'm simplifying it a little bit. I moved to Los Angeles in 2017 after a Fulbright grant to Indonesia, where I was studying these traditional crafts. And I came back with a head full of ideas that were kind of made for an audience there. So while I thought the show was successful, the local audience didn't really understand. It was frustrating. So for this show, I'm actually using batik to make paintings of Los Angeles. And I have a big studio in downtown LA with, it's an old factory building, and has this, they have big windows that look southeast. So I've just finished a painting that's like 10 feet by 14 feet. It's a 1-to-1 scale of one of the windows. And it's just, it's a painting of what
you
I
mean,
see.
You mean, hold on, it's a 1-to-1 scale of one of the windows looking out of your studio.
Yes, exactly. So it's just a depiction of contemporary Los Angeles, and my studio is near Skid Row in what they call the wholesale flower district. So on the street, you see people selling flowers, and you see people waiting for the bus, and you see people giving this Pentecostal revival, which happens every evening on Mondays. And also the skyline and imagery, like, you know, evidence of gentrification, but evidence of how things will probably not change all that much.
So you were talking about simplification, but just in terms of imagery, that sounds incredibly complex. You're painting a complex landscape. So there's figures in it. There's an enormous amount of detail, or is there not so much detail?
Yeah, I mean, I think simplifying it, there is a lot of detail. I mean, it's probably one of the more ambitious projects I've ever underwent. And, I'm happy about it. What I mean to say simplify, it's just, I think the decision, first I should say, I think that my decision to use batik in a kind of metaphorical way or in a conceptual way has legs. It's interesting. It's also kind of novel because nobody around here is making paintings using the medium, but it's just what it offers a painter in terms of facture and in terms of saturation is actually really interesting to me. So my work from about, we'll say my earliest work when I was in undergrad, was really detail oriented, lots of very specific kind of drawing and lots of figurative drawing and very exacting. And the wax line of batik just cannot be controlled very well by me. I've tried for a long time. I cannot control it all that well. So I can relinquish some of those that control and those impulses to be kind of perfect is just not possible. So when I say that this painting is simpler, I think maybe I'm speaking of that. So the figures in the painting kind of suggest figures. You know, they're not like people that you could recognize necessarily, other than the kind of archetypal. But
and all the pieces for this show are essentially kind of landscapes of LA?
Yeah, so I will just have two pieces. I'm actually showing with Tammy Nguyen, who went to Yale. She graduated a few years ago, and she's a Vietnamese artist living in, I think she's in Queens, but somewhere in New York. And so I will be making paintings of Los Angeles, downtown LA. I have this one big one, and there will be a couple of smaller ones. And then Tammy is making paintings based on spelunking, I believe, in Vietnam. So, yeah, we'll see if we can pull it off.
Yeah, that's exciting. That's exciting. And it seems like it'll also, plays a bit to L.A., right? L.A. is your home, and we're also, there's a few layers here of what home is, but it seems that that's something that could appeal to the audience, right? In terms of
I don't mean to. When I said that, I was frustrated that the audience didn't really understand what I was getting at. It's not about pandering. I don't think it's about. I think you're right. Making imagery of Los Angeles will be easier for people to relate to because they know the sources. And also, I've now lived here for 2 years, so it's natural that these stories are going to start coming out because this is the place that I think about the most now.
So that's exciting. There'll be some of those images in this interview for people to see, and also links for the show that's coming up so people can attend. Is there anything else you want to say about your work in this show before I ask you the last question? I want to encourage people to come and see it.
Just that I know it's probably corny, but it's just for whatever reason, for the past number of years, the work has come from such a place of earnestness. And I don't know, I actually have a hard time in Los Angeles. I know a lot of people are looking here right now. There's a lot of buzz, especially because Freeze is opening in a couple of weeks. But it's just a lot of the painting that is being shown and made and shown and adored here is just very cynical in all kinds of ways. And it kind of depresses me. And I have a hard time relating to a lot of the people working here. So I think that if people were coming, or want to come and see this work, it's coming from a very different place, I think, emotionally, intellectually, also in terms of just the influences. So they might be surprised at what they see.
Adam, thanks so much. I want to ask you one more question, which is, what are you reading at the moment?
I am currently reading a couple of things. One of my favorite art critics is John Berger, and I finally picked up this a collection of his, I guess, essays on particular artists, and it's called Portraits. So I've been reading that for a little while. And I'm also reading Pilgrim at Tinker Creek by Annie Dillard, just to get my head out of the art world every once in a while.
Adam, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today and wish you well on your upcoming show. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Brainerd.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.